Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike and Robin Ellicott, as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Pools.
And today we'll be continuing our reread of The Running Grave, covering chapters 11 through 13 of Part 1. Please be aware, as always, that our discussion of The Running Grave will often reference the ending of this book, as well as the rest of the books in the series. But before we get started, I think we forgot to mention it in the last episode, but there have been some rumors going around that the new season of the TV adaptation of Ink Black Heart starts filming on January 7th of next year, which is really exciting.
Rumors.
Well, here's the thing. There's only one site that substantiated it. I'm going to call it a rumor until we hear it from more than one place.
After all the Anastasia talk last week, I want to be like, huh? You heard there's a rumor in St. Petersburg. Ken gets it. Lindsay's like, I understand the reference.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see how they're going to adapt this because I don't know how they're going to do everything.
How are they going to translate huge chunks of this novel to screen? I can see with the tweets and stuff, you could have people read them out loud. You could do that little text flashing up on the screen, like in, I don't know, Sherlock or whatever. But the game?
The game is tricky. I was thinking the other day, oh, well, why don't they just have it be like an in-person meeting? And then I was like, well, that was stupid because of course they can't. How's anime going to be there?
Right.
He's like the Wizard of Oz where he's just behind a curtain with a voice changer. If they do that, and I'm right.
Maybe they'll just do it like they'll just take World of Warcraft and have everyone be in an RP service standing around as their characters talking.
Anyway, it's going to be, I'm really looking forward to it.
I'm intrigued. I'm excited to see what happens.
Can't wait to see the Ritz scene.
Oh, I forgot that was going to be on screen.
I know.
Oh my God. All right.
Gotta emotionally prepare for that.
Are there any scenes that you really hope make it in?
Oh, hotel whiskey with the boobs. Mm. Strike giving her a plant, helping her move in. If that's not the one I was going to say, swear to God, I will riot. That's my top priority.
I really want Robin interviewing Yasmin. I want the actress to nail it.
Yeah. Okay, that would be really funny.
I was just joking, but now I kind of do.
Oh, that would be awful. I want Comic-Con.
What about Naked Pez?
Depends on the actor that they get.
They're not going to show it.
Can you go full frontal Hang Dong on BBC?
I'm sorry,
probably
what?
Not.
Never heard that before.
It's from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. But I'm still curious. We could do some careful blocking of the sketch pad. Yeah. I'm sure Holiday's face would be very expressive of what she's seeing.
That would be amazing.
It would be very funny and very good, yes.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, though. It's going to be exciting. I'm guessing if they're filming the beginning of the year, it's the same with Troubled Blood, so I would imagine that we'll get it next fall.
Oh my God. Along with Book 8?
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Whew. I mean, crossing our fingers there.
No, I feel it's going to happen.
All right, should we do our Q&A?
Let's do it. All right, so the Q&A for this episode. Historical family tensions come to light for Strike in this book. How do they affect his familial relationships?
I think Strike does reach several reckonings in this book, and one of them is definitely reevaluating certain things in his past and coming to a reckoning with his sister Lucy, and also with his new half-sister Prudence, who of course has always been his half-sister, but he's never really had a relationship with her. And that's an area of growth, but it's painful growth, as growth often is, of course. He has to accept that some of the pigeonholes he's put people into no longer apply. He sees his sister Lucy a little more clearly. I can't say too much, but it was very cathartic to write because I've always known this was coming. So it's very satisfying to reach the place where you finally share things with the reader.
This was one of the answers that really made me smile because I love the Lucy bits we get in this book and I love them for the reasons Joe gives. It is a huge area of growth for Strike where he has realized that he really hasn't given Lucy the full credit or maybe even the respect that she deserves. I don't think that all of their relationship issues were his fault, but where he has failed in the past, I think he did those things right in this book.
Absolutely agree. They both did things right in this
book. Yeah.
Obviously, Strike's growth is what we're focused on because he's the protagonist. But part of what makes Joe's worlds feel so alive and real is that all of these other minor characters are growing and changing too. They're never just static. You really get the sense that every single person in these books is out there living their lives and we're just getting occasional peeps at them through Strike's window. Lucy's been dealing with her past and going to therapy and being a good mom and hiding her other half siblings from him out of guilt.
Yeah.
It all results and it all comes out in this amazing moment.
My favorite thing about this answer is her saying that it was cathartic to write because she knew it was coming.
Mm-hmm.
I have definitely complained about Lucy and taken Strike's side in a lot of things, but I have also always felt that this healing between them was coming. It's why I couldn't fully let go of the hope that she'd be completely okay with Prudence after Ink Black Heart. Mm-hmm. And it's also why I can't simply hate Linda, because mm-hmm. I know a resolution is coming there too.
About Linda in particular, I totally agree with you that that resolution mm-hmm. is coming. And
oh yeah,
it's going to be equally cathartic.
I think so.
Right? I think it has to be. I can't wait to read that.
Yeah. It's also extremely exciting when you put that in another context, because mm-hmm. you can only imagine what else is going to be cathartic to write. I think we all mm-hmm. picked up on that.
Oh, yeah. You are not the only one whose mind went there instantly.
Oh, yeah.
I'm convinced that's why she's been writing so fast, because she's getting to the good bits now. Mm-hmm. She's done the setup. Now she's getting to the payoff.
She's mm-hmm. incredibly patient. Can you imagine?
No. I can't even cook things on lower than medium heat because I'm too impatient. I burn all my scrambled eggs because I'm like, cook fucking faster. I can't do this. I've been here for 1 minute already. So, no, yeah, I'm amazed at her patience and the long game she's set up.
Yeah. I'm thankful she does, though, because it's worth it.
It's delightful. Mm-hmm. It truly is.
Let's jump into chapter 11.
So in chapter 11, Strike goes to Lucy's house to tell her about the case's connection to their past. So the epigraph for this chapter, 6 in the 5th place, shock goes hither and thither. However, nothing at all is lost. And that's from hexagram 51, the arousing, shock, and thunder.
Just looking at this passage for the chapter, shock goes hither and thither is, I think, a reference to both Strike and Lucy facing shock in this chapter. Mm-hmm. Lucy is shocked to learn about the investigation and by Strike's honesty about Leda, and Strike is shocked to learn about what happened to Lucy at the commune. And also he's shocked by some of Lucy's behavior too.
Mm-hmm.
But the second line is really the beautiful part of this, you know, when it says, however, nothing at all is lost, because it speaks to the healing aspect of truth finally being spoken between brother and sister, and it does not cause a loss in their connection. It instead strengthens it. The actual hexagram talks about shock bringing success, and that's exactly what happens here. I just think that this is a beautiful chapter, and it's a beautiful epigraph.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right about that, especially about not bringing loss, but in fact gain, strength in the relationship. So the image in this hexagram says, thus in fear and trembling, the superior man sets his life in order and examines himself. And that is just what this shock and other shocks in this book cause the superior man, Strike, to do, to reflect inwards, to assess his beliefs and his actions, to correct his course and choose a better path.
Yeah. Also, thank you for, again, referring to him as a superior man. I like when we can slip that in every time.
You know, I know it. I know you like seeing it. So I'm going to.
I do.
Try to work it in.
Thank you.
All right. So this chapter starts off with Robin calling Strike back after attending her first UHC meeting while Strike is on his way to Lucy's to give him an update.
This is a very small thing, but it says that Strike had a bag from Hamley's on his lap. And I had to look this up because I did not remember that this was the toy shop. It's the same one he goes to in Trouble Blood and Cuckoo's Calling when he buys gifts for his nephews.
Oh, which is a parallel back to book one and back to the in the triples theory.
One in five. You're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sure everyone who lives in the UK is thinking, well, yeah, duh. But this is just one of those things that fits better when you know the context, because it helps set the scene. He's sitting with a bag of toys on his lap. As soon as you hear that in Bromley Station, I was like, oh, he's going to Lucy's. But I didn't catch that quite at first, you know.
You should be a detective.
I should be a detective.
That's a good deduction.
This line here, while he loved Lucy, they had very little in common, and outsiders tended to express disbelief that they were related at all, given that Lucy was small and blonde. So this is interesting to me for a few reasons. Number one, I love the emphasis that he loves his sister, because we don't always see that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It says something very similar when we first meet her in Cuckoo's Calling. So it says he was fonder of her than almost anyone in his life, and yet their interactions were often unsatisfactory, laden with familiar anxieties and arguments.
Yeah. His love for Lucy, and I too love that he calls it love, it's rooted strongly in their shared past experiences, which is why the subject of the past being broached here in this chapter lets us see that love more obviously than we have ever mm-hmm. before, rather than just being told he loves her, I think.
Yeah.
And my point in saying that is that I desperately hope we get more scenes of them discussing the past at some point in the upcoming books, like in reference to Lita's murder, maybe, because yeah. again, I think that's where the love comes through the strongest.
Yeah. And also, now that they have both realized, I think, that they do have more in common than they once thought.
Yeah.
We might be able to see that love kind of showing itself in different ways.
That would be really, really great.
And then lastly, there's something interesting to me about seeing the physical differences between Strike and Lucy being described here, when just a couple of chapters back, we saw the physical similarities being described between Strike and Prudence. I'm not sure if there's anything deeper here, but it just stood out to me.
Maybe that contrast is set up deliberately to sort of lead into this twist that you were just talking about, that though on the surface they appear very different and Strike thinks they're different, they're actually really similar underneath. You just have mm-hmm. to look closer than with Prudence. I guess what I'm saying is that the similarities between Strike and Lucy aren't because of their genetics. They're not the physical similarities. It's because of that experience of having suffered shared trauma together and coming out of it with the same desire to fix the world around them, even mm-hmm. though they haven't realized that that's, or at least Strike hasn't realized that's what Lucy's doing. Yeah.
The remainder of the paragraph says, Strike was undertaking today's visit out of a sense of duty, not pleasure, and was anticipating a difficult couple of hours. Hmm. When I first read this, while I was very optimistic about Strike's growth in this book, I definitely took this line the wrong way, because I thought that this was kind of the same old thing where he was attending something that Lucy had invited him to that he didn't want to go to.
And I was going to complain about it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's what I thought was happening. So I was immediately very pleasantly surprised to find out what was actually happening, because I was proud of him. I was like, oh, Strike, I'm proud of you.
Oh, right?
Good job.
You know, it was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
Especially because he could have called her.
I mean, I guess he would want to have that conversation face to face.
Yeah. I was just thinking, oh, here we go again. Strike doesn't want to go to Lucy's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what? The Strike in book one would have called her to tell her. And now the growth is that he's like, I need to actually make the effort and tell her this face to face, because it's such an important thing.
I think that there are a lot of little steps in mm-hmm. this chapter that lead yeah. to where they get to be. Each mm-hmm. of them making small decisions that, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And that's what growth is. Little tiny steps, all adding up to big steps. One small step to the toy shop, one giant leap in our relationship.
Wow. Okay.
That's a bit batshit.
When Strike asked Robin over the phone how the UHC meeting went, she says that it wasn't what she was expecting, that she thought it would be more fire and brimstone, but it's wall-to-wall social justice and being free to have doubts.
Mm.
And I just thought wall-to-wall social justice being used as this sort of facade, it feels very relevant to today with all the virtue signaling online, social media. It almost feels like in today's world, the UHC would have no problem being what it is, because people don't see through that.
Yes. When Joe talked about trying to create a cult that would make sense in contemporary Britain, the West, she nailed it, because that virtue signaling is, oh, mm-hmm. I agree with you. It's especially effective for the UHC if they're recruiting in urban environments, which they clearly are, where there's a higher proportion of people who would describe themselves as super liberal, right? The UHC knows their audience. They're in these big yeah. cities because that's where the money is and the people. And the people in these cities are going to subscribe more to that wall-to-wall social justice virtue signaling than to the fire and brimstone stuff.
Yeah, I've been watching a lot of Leah Remini's TikToks.
Mm-hmm.
And there was one the other day that felt very relevant to this and the UHC, because it was talking about how celebrities are treated differently in Scientology. In particular, one person,
whom we won't name,
whose name rhymes with Bomb Bruce. But she was saying in that video that people put up with the different treatment because they believe that they are literally saving the planet.
Yeah.
So that's very, very similar to what the UHC is doing. Same kind of thing.
Yeah.
Go follow Leah Remini on TikTok, by the way. She has great Scientology videos.
I think I did when you sent her to me. I just don't think I've seen, I think I've seen like one.
I like listening to her talk anyway, because she has like a strong, is it New York accent or something? I don't know. She'll be like the coffee.
Coffee. Nice.
Strike asks if anyone tried to recruit her, and she brings up that blonde woman who Robin thinks must know how expensive Prudence's clothes are. Mm-hmm. Do we know who she is? Is she at Chapman Farm?
I don't believe that we ever see her again or learn her name. She might have shown up at the farm later, and I just can't remember because those chapters were a bit traumatic.
Yeah.
I'm assuming that she's someone who's stationed in London specifically to do recruiting in the temple.
Yeah.
You know, that seems like it's her sort of area.
I was just finding myself suddenly interested in her and where she stays. You know, do they teach these greeters how to keep an eye out for certain people with expensive clothing?
But I bet that part of the training they go through when they learn the higher level truths about finding new members is about how to, I guess, be open to being guided to recruits who can most enrich the church.
I hear lots of air quotes.
Tons of air quotes, which is probably just a mentor taking them out and pointing out and explaining the signs they're being shown in the wild about, yeah. You know, does that make sense? Like a sort of on the street training.
Mm-hmm. Next, we have this bit where Robin sees the number 48 and didn't say anything to Strike. I don't think that we were so much worried, but I know that this caused a lot of people a lot of paranoia when the sample came out and before we could read the rest of the book, as far as like how effective this brainwashing and the cult strategies were going to be on her.
Well, the fact that she laughed about it did not imply to me that she was impressed. It was just like, that's funny, right? Because I don't think I ever thought that Robin was actually going to believe any of this was supernatural. No. You know, she studied psychology, so I had no doubt that she would be aware of what this is, and that's why she was laughing. But not finishing the conversation about it with Strike, it does add to the tension a bit. It would also be too soon to explain away the mystery with logic.
Yeah, you want to leave it open for the readers a bit to keep them worried. But I was never too worried about this either. I just assumed that when they had a chance to chat later, one of them either would have Googled the trick or Strike might have already known what it is off the top of his head. Yeah. Basically, so if I'm capable of Googling something, I assume that Robin is and has Googled that thing because she's the queen of Google.
Yeah, she definitely would have. And it does seem like one of those random things that Strike would know all about off the top of his head, you know?
Yeah, he knows bunch of random shit.
Yeah, he does. He'd be really good at Jeopardy.
So there's actually a minor error here. So with the NASCAR driver whose name Robin sees, the name of the driver is actually Jimmy Johnson rather than Jimmy Jones. Now, I wonder if that's just an error or if it's supposed to be like some subtle reference to Jim Jones and the People's Temple, since that was another cult. But I'm not sure.
It was. I don't know. I think I'm more inclined to believe it was a mistake, because if she wanted to make a reference to Jonestown, she probably could have made a more direct one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd think, right?
Yeah. Here's something that I've always wondered, though, that's kind of connected. If you're going to use someone's name or song or reference their book or something, do you need to get their permission? Because I don't know a lot about writing or publishing books, but I've always wondered that if she has to ask permission, if she puts somebody's name in like that.
I'm pretty sure that you don't need to get permission or give credit just for using a name or naming the title of a work or a real life location, right? Because that's public domain part of the world. I think it would just be for actual excerpts of someone else's creative property or their IP, like song lyrics, right?
Yeah, that's fascinating to me, though, because I'm just imagining being an artist and getting an email one day from J.K. Rowling's people. Can she use your lyric in an upcoming book?
Oh my God, I'd be like, yes, can we have a meeting and sit down and talk about it? Maybe over tea and cakes.
Now I'm just thinking about all the people who she's had to email. Joni Mitchell, obviously, huge one.
Yeah.
Blue Oyster Cult.
I'd be like, Joe, have my lyrics, have my anything. You want my firstborn? It's all yours. Take any, just sit down with me and talk about it. And that's, we're good. Maybe she doesn't have to ask permission to use it if she cites it, though.
Yeah, I'm wondering that too.
Interesting.
If anybody knows, let us know.
Yeah.
Also, to your point, Pools, from last time about there being so many mentions of Americans, these men with the NASCAR jerseys, they were American too.
I'm not surprised that the men wearing NASCAR jerseys are American. But like, who else would wear a NASCAR jersey?
Is that an American thing?
It must be. I mean, people outside America don't follow NASCAR, do they?
I have no idea.
I don't either.
I don't follow it, and I'm in America.
That was a derail, but yes, the Americans are everywhere.
You got to watch out for them.
They're tricky. They're sneaky.
Yeah.
Sneaky little fuckers.
I've heard. Added to the list of complaints about Americans.
And it's hard to be sneaky when they're so loud.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
But I take issue with that one because I am very quiet.
You're a very quiet American.
Anyway. Here's a line here that says, Strike, who didn't particularly want to forfeit the distraction of talking to Robin while he headed towards an encounter he was dreading, said goodbye, then continued walking, his feeling of foreboding growing ever deeper. Lucy had sounded thrilled that he was coming over, which made the prospect of delivering his news even less palatable. So first, It's always adorable to see Shrike wanting to talk to Robin when he's feeling down, especially because we know he's going to lose that and it's going to be something he misses.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait till they get to a point where he can just say, no, don't go. I want to just chat with you. I miss your voice.
They're so close.
They're so close to that. And I want it to happen.
I know. And second, the final sentence is when it clicked for me that Shrike had been the one to arrange the meeting and he was going to tell her about the case. And I remember actually stopping for a second to go, Shrike, good for you.
So proud. It's also lovely that he's dreading specifically bringing her mood down with this news because he knows she's not going to be happy.
Yeah.
Maybe one day he could do a surprise visit just for fun. But I mean, he's done a lot of growth, so I'm not going to push him on that. Baby
steps. Yeah. So Shrike arrives at Lucy's house and immediately encounters Jack, who is adorable and endearing as always.
Yeah, I 100% believe that Jack knew Shrike was on his way over and rushed to open the door so that he could see him.
Oh, of course
he did.
Just like Gus did, but this is much sweeter.
Okay. They are very different boys.
They are.
Can you believe that Jack is around 13 here?
I know. How old was he when we first met him? I guess I could do math. And
it was his 7th birthday party at the beginning of April in Cuckoo's Calling. He was just a baby. Mm. And now in less than a month from where we are in this chapter, he is turning 13.
Strike's going to have to stop shopping at that toy shop for them now. You know,
I think the gifts suddenly get a lot more expensive when they become teenagers.
They get more expensive and smaller.
Yeah. When can he start just giving them cards full of cash?
Now.
Great. Because he's going to like that. Now. He's going to be a fan of that shift, I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. No more shopping at Hamley's. Go to the ATM. Here's your cash. Piss off.
Absolutely. That's what I do with my cousin's kids who are now older.
It's what they want.
Yeah. I'm like, Taylor, I just text you a gift card to Target. Happy birthday. And she's like, awesome. Thank you.
Also, Shrike and Jack's banter is perfect.
As always. Yeah,
Jack is very much like his uncle, isn't he?
They share a sense of humor.
They do.
I hope that they stay close as he grows up.
So we've talked about being proud of Shrike and, you know, the changes that he's making. Look at Shrike making an effort to get gifts for all of his nephews and not just one.
Wow.
When I talked before about Shrike doing things right with Lucy in this book, this is one of those things, because no one will convince me that Shrike was right in Trouble of Blood about this.
Yeah.
Now, of course, he does have an ulterior motive here with these gifts, right? He wants to get them out of the house, but I don't think that takes away from his thoughtfulness, right? In fact, it's extremely thoughtful towards Lucy. Because he's anticipating taking this burden off of her, right? It's actually quite sweet.
Oh, yeah. He's like, don't worry, Lucy. I'll get the kids out of the way.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
That is cute. That's a smart strategy, too.
It almost seems like Jack is working together with Shrike about this whole getting them out of the house thing, because he's talking about wanting to take their gifts outside and, oh, we'll put boots on. And him confirming his position as his uncle's favorite is just perfect.
That was so cute.
I have no issue with him having a favorite nephew. He and Jack have a special bond, but I do think it's growth for him to realize that that's an inside thought. You know, it's not one you say out loud, and certainly not to their mother.
Yeah, inside versus outside thoughts.
I've also just noticed that Lucy hugs Shrike hello too, because I remember saying that I liked this when Prudence hugs him hello, but I'm now realizing Lucy does it too. And I'm trying to think if we've ever seen them hug before. I mean, I know that he puts his arm around her when they spread Joan's ashes, but I don't know if we've ever seen them hug. It's just Shrike being more physically affectionate with his sisters, I think, is a good sign to me of more openness, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I did a quick flip through of times when they've greeted each other, and I'm pretty sure we've never seen him greet her with a hug. Usually because when they greet each other, she's accosting him about who he hasn't or has brought to some party.
Yeah.
Like, poor Marguerite, you know. But I suppose that, you know, a more friendly greeting might also have something to do with her growth. Maybe a bit more chill about Shrike's choices.
Yeah, and she's probably seeing that he is making some changes too.
Yeah, she is.
Because when Shrike asks for a small bit of banana bread because he's still not at his goal weight, I bet Lucy notices that and she's proud of him for that and for quitting smoking, right?
Oh, big time. Yes. Is Lucy the only one who doesn't mention how thin he's looking, seeing him for the first time in this book? Because everyone else seems to, but she doesn't say anything about it to him.
Yeah, that's true. Well, maybe she just has her mind on other things.
Yeah, it's possible.
Yeah. Also, banana bread. Delicious.
Oh my God, it really is.
As soon as I heard Lucy was making banana bread, I was like, oh, that sounds so good.
I feel like if she makes banana bread for him, Shrike would pop over for more surprise visits.
I would.
But yeah, agreed. It really should be classified as cake, though. I feel like we only call it bread so that we feel less guilty eating it. you know?
That and it comes in loaf form. That and there's no frosting. That's a joke for Anna Kiera. She'll understand.
Muffins are also cake. Muffins are breakfast cake, and I'll die on this hill.
It didn't take us long to start talking about food.
Yeah, it really didn't.
Lucy mentions Ted and his failing memory, and I don't know how you guys feel about this, but I feel like this doesn't really bode well for Ted in the future. Like, he could probably die before the series ends. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I think we've said that at some point, that that seems likely. I would be surprised if he didn't die before the series ended, now that we know that he's been diagnosed.
Yeah, he seems like the kind of man who doesn't long outlive when his partner dies. Like, some people just...
And there's a sweetness to that, too, that when Ted does die, because Joan talked about when he can join me.
Oh, I really hope we get to see Strike and Lucy taking Ted out to be with Joan at some point.
I think we will.
Oh, we'd better. Okay.
Oh, man.
My emotions. I bet Polworth has a boat they can use if they have to sell Ted's.
Well, maybe Polworth will take it.
Okay. Yeah. I bet Polworth will take it.
And then Strike and the kids can use it whenever they go down to visit or something, you know?
Yeah. You know what? That's comforted my heart. Thank you, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
That was upsetting me, and now I feel better.
Lindsay, I think you and I feel like a few of our listeners have brought this up too, but as far as potential future plot points, I think we've talked about Ted maybe revealing stuff about Leda or Rokeby.
Yeah, I think someone had mentioned that sometimes people with dementia can start reliving old memories. Mm-hmm. He might even talk to Strike like he's still a child. There is a great scene in the show Afterlife with Ricky Gervais, and I think it's David Bradley. Is that his name, who played Filch? Yeah, that's him. So I could see that happening and being very sweet, and something from the past coming up when he thinks he's talking to child Strike or something, you know? I also had this other thought, because I was wondering what color Joan's hair was. I know in the show, the woman who played her had dark hair. Mm-hmm. But I'm just kind of having this fantasy of Robin meeting Ted and him talking to her like she's Joan.
Okay. Aww. Well, that would murder me. And for some reason, I too thought that Joan was blonde.
Yeah, but I don't know where.
Find it in the text. Just says she has gray hair and troubled blood.
Yeah.
Maybe it was because she had China blue eyes. And I'm like, I associate that with blonde hair. But hey, Robin has blue eyes too, so maybe that's the connection there.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, I do think that Ted's dementia and him moving to London means that the big clue that's going to set this Leda investigation into motion is coming up. The only question is Joe saving it for a one book plot at the end of the series to go out with a bang, or will she maybe start laying these threads down in 8 and 9 for the full solve in 10? I think I'd guess the second, only because I don't know that Ted will survive until book 10 to give them the big clue then.
Yeah, I agree. Not just because of that, but because it's a very J.K. Rowling thing to do, to start laying you know, threads. I think she probably already has when it comes to Leda's murder.
More
the bigger stuff.
Threads that the characters themselves are conscious of and thinking of, you know? But yeah, I agree.
You know what else I was also thinking of the other day is, I wonder if Ted knows anything about Switch.
Ooh, that's a good question.
It's always kind of been interesting to me, knowing Ted and Joan and how much they did for Strike and Lucy, that there's never any mention of Switch. And I know they don't have any legal right to these kids. Yeah. So Whitaker's grandparents probably took him away. But I'm wondering if they ever maintained any sort of contact with him.
Yeah, I'm curious.
If they did, if they know anything about who he is, you know, just I'm curious about Switch.
Switch has got to be coming.
He's got to.
That's a thing.
So the next part says, Strike, who was experiencing the familiar sense of constriction Lucy often gave him, whereby he was asked to commit immediately to future arrangements and often had to deal with her irritability when he couldn't instantly fall in with her plans. Today, however, Lucy merely sat a slice of banana bread down in front of him, followed shortly afterwards by a mug of tea.
That sounds nice.
Yeah. So this is one of those times where I wish I could be in Lucy's head a bit, because I'd like to know why she chose not to approach it like she usually does. Like you were saying earlier, is there growth happening with her too? Or is she just too worried about Ted to push it? She doesn't want to ruin the visit. I want to know.
It could be just as simple as her not having chosen a date yet to visit herself. So this response is satisfactory for now.
Yeah.
Or maybe, like you said, she's so happy about a spontaneous visit and toys for the boys that she's just letting it go know a bit.
So here's where Jack and Adam come running into the kitchen and thank Strike for the gifts. It says he bought them a Storm Fire Tech bow, and I looked these up. I think I found the exact one that he would have bought, although there's some variations now. It's this giant bow that has giant arrows that you can launch, and I assume that they're soft like a Nerf gun.
Okay, that sounds cool as hell. Strike is actually pretty good at picking up gifts for kids, isn't he? I feel like his track record is pretty decent here.
My first thought, though, I was wondering if they might be getting a little bit old for them, like especially Luke. But then I realized that I bet even Strike wouldn't mind launching one of these arrows across the, you know, across the yard. Yeah. It looks fun. I would want to do it.
Hell yeah, me too. Listen, put one of these things in my hands and suddenly I'm Katniss Everdeen liberating Pan Am, you know?
Yeah.
It is a basic fact of life that one is never too old to try to nail your sibling in the face with a foam arrow. I would absolutely shoot my brother in the face with one. And my sister. Yeah. And my husband.
So we learned the real reason that Strike is there, and that's to tell Lucy that the UHC case has the potential to generate some press and bring up things from their past, which I really like. That's very considerate.
I was interested in the moment where Lucy's face tightens because she doesn't consider Lita her mom when Strike calls her that. Just because it reminded me a bit of that scene in Silkworm with Al, where it says, "Rokeby knows Vancourt," asked Strike, forgetting his resolution. "Yeah," said Al with a slight frown. "Then, let's face it, Dad knows everyone." Just because in both cases, we see the way that Strike refers to a shared parent annoying a half-sibling. Of course, the actual feelings towards the parent on Strike's side are reversed. Now, I don't really know where I was going with this, other than that it makes me angry at Al for not understanding that Strike was hurt by Rokeby, because Strike was trying not to call Rokeby Rokeby in consideration of Al's feelings, and Al was the one to get mad. Whereas here we see Strike in the opposite position, in the position Al's in, understanding and empathizing with Lucy's perspective.
Yeah, I think you went to a great place with that. It's a great observation. And it's another way where Strike and Lucy are similar that maybe he hasn't picked up on. If he ever has or will realize that Lucy feels about Leda the way he feels about Rokeby, I think there's a lot to be unpacked there.
Oh, yeah. Someone should connect those dots for him a little bit.
Yeah, maybe he has, but maybe
we just don't know, but yeah.
Lucy's reaction to finding out the UHC is connected to the commune that they stayed at as children is just heartbreaking.
I love the description where it says Lucy slumped back in her chair as though the words had hit her physically, her expression blank.
That physical reaction, it shows the visceral, like the gut punch.
Yeah, it also just reminds me that the boys are in the backyard shooting arrows because it feels like she got hit with one.
Oh, you know? Yeah, that's good.
It's not, but yeah.
No, it is good.
Okay, so was Lucy 6 when this happened? Because I'm not trying to start a thing about inconsistency with ages. I know that's a thing.
I mean, if we go by the sort of new ages of 4 years apart that we were given lately, and Strike was there at 12, then she would have been 8. If it's by their ages as given in CC, it said in Cuckoo's Calling that they were 8 and 6 at the commune, but that's blatantly contradicted. So
wasn't that change in Troubled Blood, though? They eventually changed that to that 4 years to 2 years.
Did they change it to 2 years? I would be really happy if I learned that they'd changed that, because
maybe
been
I just thought
nuts.
That they did. I thought that was one of the things they fixed, or maybe it's
would
I don't
that
know.
Be in the ebook?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't updated mine though, because I know it wants to give me the TV cover edition, and I don't want it. So I never update them. So I don't know.
Someone let us know if they fixed that. But whether or not they fixed the difference in ages, Strike says in this book, in this chapter, that he was 12 when he was at the commune, which is blatant contradiction.
I've always pictured him as 8.
Because that's what it was in Cuckoo's Calling.
Yeah. So I guess my mind just completely skipped over that, because I did not even remember that he said that. So
that was a complete retcon. but I guess we're going to have to go by what's given in this book, which would be 12 and either 10 or 8.
I also love that Lucy here, once again in this chapter, does not react the way that Strike expects her to act, because he was expecting anger. And I think that's the reason he says her crying was worse, because he's used to her being angry. He was probably completely prepared to deal with it. I think it's why he immediately said that he didn't know until he had taken the case, because he was already planning his defense.
Yeah, he's better at dealing with anger than tears, I think.
I think that's easier to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
Yeah, just get angry back.
Tears must be worse for him because he suspects expects now that there are things that he doesn't want to hear. Anger being in the press means that nothing happened.
Yeah, the tears are the first suspicious sign.
Yeah.
And his growing worry and suspicion of the truth before Lucy reveals it in this chapter is great because he can see the inconsistency with what he believes about his sister in the past and what's happening now, the reaction that Lucy is having. And resolving that inconsistency means that a part of his conception of the world is about to be completely upended. Yeah. And it's dawning on him with these tears that things are not like I thought they were.
This line really gets me when it says, "She broke down completely. Strike pushed himself up from the table and walked towards her. He half expected her to push him away, but she let him put his arms around her and pull her close so that she was sobbing into her brother's chest. They stood thus for barely a minute when the front door opened." I know.
So, so sweet. I would be very happy to cry into Strike's chest with his big, strong arms around me when I'm having a bad day.
Would that cheer you up a bit?
I think it would cheer me up immensely.
Yeah.
Ooh, so solid. So warm.
Anyway,
let's go on from this quickly or we're going to get stuck here. This is not what Lucy is thinking, obviously.
Obviously.
Lucy, this is a brother thing.
I'm wondering, how old is Luke if his voice is just starting to crack? I'm guessing that he and Jack aren't that far apart in age, maybe like a year or two.
Well, it says that his voice had broken since Strike had last seen him, which that means that it's already changed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, if Jack is just turning 13, I could see Luke being like 15, and that would be in the right age for his voice having broken, right?
Oh, yeah.
I don't know much about teenage boys.
All right, so Greg enters the kitchen, and oh boy. Have there been any moments in these books when Greg doesn't suck? Because I'm pretty sure that the only time that I can think of is when Jack was ill in Lethal White, and that's about the only time I can think of.
I mean, I don't think he was bad in Troubled Blood either.
Oh.
That's just canon in your head.
Just because it's in my head doesn't mean it's not real, Lindsay.
In this case, I think it does.
Okay.
I think
it does. Agree to disagree.
I think besides his attitude about Ted here, there's only been one other time where I disliked him through my own observations without Strike's influence or through Strike's eyes. Mm-hmm. And that's when he made that comment to Nick and Ilsa in Silkworm about not having a baby. I wanted to punch him in the face for Ilsa. Yeah. You know, mm-hmm. I hated that.
That was one of the many times that I've wanted to punch Greg in the face. Yes. Listen, I think we all know that I've loathed Greg ever since we saw him manning the iPod at a party, set up a playlist and go do some real work for the party. Bud, this is Matthew behavior.
I don't know. It sounds smart to me. I don't have to mingle.
Yeah, that's the point. But on a serious note, just so I don't get into my tinfoil conspiracy theories about Greg, I have to wonder, given that Lucy hides her distress from him as well as her kids here, does he know what happened to her?
I don't know. I don't know if we can really guess. I don't think her hiding this from him means yes or no. I don't think we have enough information about the relationship to know.
Yeah, you're probably right.
Anyway, his attitude towards Ted's failing health is maybe it's partially, maybe mostly because we're reading this through Strike's eyes, but it just seems irritating and kind of callous to me.
I think at this point, they're only beginning to worry about Ted. Mm-hmm. So there's still hope that this isn't a problem. It's still probably not anything on his radar that we really need to worry about this right now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not making an argument that he's, you know, so hopeful that Ted's okay because he cares so much. I don't think that that's true, but
yeah,
this would be a real
hardship
for the whole family and he doesn't want to deal with that.
I definitely agree with your analysis of his motivations there.
Yeah, well, we could talk more about his responses later, but I don't think that his attitude is totally uncommon.
No.
I don't know. I've just heard that this diagnosis can be very difficult for family and caregivers.
Yes.
So I think it's a really complicated issue. And to be fair, I do think he makes fair arguments against Ted moving in with them later on.
Yeah.
But I understand because this was one of the moments where I independently was annoyed with him because he's just not comforting.
Yeah. For me, the fact that he says what he does dismissively rather than something like reassuringly is what makes it a bit off to me. It's all about the tone, because you're right, he does make some good points about, you know, we don't know for sure, and later about Ted moving in. Kind of agree with him on the facts, but the tone,
the delivery
I'm less here for. But yeah,
one other thing that I thought was interesting that Joe drew attention to was that picture of Ted and Joan from the 80s, and then Strike wanting to turn the picture to face the wall.
I love the way Joan's hair is described.
Yes. As big as you make it.
This part where he wants to turn the picture around, it almost hits a comical note because I think that whole thing is a pretty common trope in comedies, right? Mm-hmm. But this is actually really sweet when he wants to do it because they had dedicated so much of their lives to trying to protect the niece and nephew whom Leda dumped on them, then removed as unpredictably as she did everything. I just feel like Strike thinking about how much they had dedicated their lives to protecting them is quite an acknowledgement. It's very sweet.
Aww. It really is.
But it is a little bit funny.
It is. He wants to protect them right back. He wants to shield them from the knowledge that they couldn't always succeed in protecting him, even though it's just that, like you said, that comic trope of turning the picture to face the wall. It's still that impulse, right?
But so this is when it all starts clicking for Strike that Lucy had not escaped the sexual abuse at the commune. And obviously this is horrible for Lucy. There's this line here that I feel really sad for Strike where it says, in his memory, he had always been with Lucy sticking close, trying to make sure she wasn't invited anywhere by either of the Crowther brothers. I just can't imagine a child so young, however old Strike was, with that kind of responsibility or the awareness that he needed to keep her away from certain adults. It's very sad.
It really is. And imagine how much experience he'd had already to be picking up on that fact that these men are dangerous because he's been around dangerous men before because of his mother. This isn't even the first time, you know, he knows.
It just says so much to me about who Strike is now when, you know, he gets protective or, you know, it's like, well, of course he is.
Fierce protector.
This next bit is heartbreaking. Jo really paints a really great picture here when she says, from their adjoining mattresses on the floor, brother and sister had whispered at night how much they had hated the place, how much they wished Leda would take them away.
Yeah, it makes me wonder if they had ever asked her to leave or at least to let them go with Ted and Joan.
I'm guessing experience had taught them that Leda wouldn't have listened to any such request, so they no longer bothered to do it.
Just why couldn't this be one of the times where she left them?
Right? Like, why did she need to bring them here?
Why would she want to?
I guess she kept picking them up and taking them because she wanted to be near them because I guess she loved them, but this isn't...
I know we've talked about this before when we did Troubled Blood, but I still feel so sad for what it must have been like for Ted and Joan to have these kids that you love, but not have the legal right to protect them or even know where they are for 6 months, not knowing if they're safe, being afraid to pursue something legally, because then what if they hate you?
Yeah, that's such a hard position to be in.
It must have been so hard for them.
So next we get Lucy's feelings about having a girl child.
I honestly really don't know how I feel about this. I mean, there's an honesty here from Lucy where she knows that this would be really hard for her. But I don't really know what to think about it.
Well, I think she's wrong that she would have been a lousy mother to a girl. She would have had to fight her instincts to be overprotective. Although there's nothing wrong with having her eyes open to the realities of the risks that girls face. But judging by her commitment to being a good mother to her boys, plus the fact that she's in therapy, I think she'd have worked to be a good mom to a girl and balanced her instincts. And I think she'd have done great.
You're probably right. I do like the honesty of knowing what you would have really struggled with and just thinking, well, this is better.
And then,
when we find out what happened to Lucy.
We don't have to describe what it actually was, right?
No.
We all remember this bit. I don't want to say it.
It says that Lucy had a determination to pretend that the life to which Leda had subjected them was as long dead as Leda herself. And I have to say, I don't think Lucy's the only one.
I mean, how often have we seen Strike try very deliberately not to think about things that have happened during his childhood, right? That whole scene in Career of Evil where he flashbacks to Whittaker and is furious that he can't stop himself. He usually suppresses the hell out of those memories.
I just read another one in Troubled Blood the other day where he thinks about the caves in Dave Polworth and he says, don't think about it.
One could argue that Lucy getting therapy to deal with the effects of her childhood shows a lot more acknowledgement that it happened than Strike's habits do, you know?
Is Strike making like a camel and sticking water in his hump? So next we get to Lucy's rage at Mizzou, Leda, and Dr. Coates. Lucy describing Mizzou being complicit in the abuse of these other girls, like I didn't really like Mizzou to begin with, but that's horrific.
I understand her anger at Leda because she was the one person who was supposed to protect her. With Mizzou, it feels like a complicated thing because when we meet Mizzou, she's grown and I really don't have much sympathy for her left at that point, but it's complicated when you think about her as a 15-year-old because she was still a child, likely abused, groomed.
Yeah.
I don't blame Lucy at all for her feelings. I think they're completely valid, but it is a complicated thing that's very real.
It is. Yeah. I too understand Lucy's anger being directed primarily at Lita and Mazu, in the sense that it is, I think, an incredibly common response to something like this. It makes me think perhaps it has something to do with expectations and betrayal, because we expect a predator to inflict harm. We expect our mother to protect us, but she basically serves us up to the predators. We expect sisterhood and solidarity from other girls, but Mazu deliberately drags other girls to face the same harm that she did. That betrayal of shattered trust, where that trust was misplaced, that seems to be what's really feeding Lucy's anger here. Mm-hmm. There is, of course, a conversation to be had about the larger societal tendency to blame women for men's actions. Rule one of misogyny, women are responsible for what men do. And to see men who are predatory as just a force of nature that can't help themselves, because it is a perspective that's pretty deeply entrenched in our society. But we can acknowledge that larger tendency while at the same time seeing and validating Lucy's fury at being betrayed by those who were supposed to be protecting her.
I agree with everything you've said. I actually feel like I can speak to this in a small way, because I had a harassment issue at my job years ago.
Yeah.
And sometimes when I think back on that, I feel more angry now at my employers and HR than I am at the actual harassment. That's the part that still makes me really angry, because it goes to what you're saying about their "oh well" attitude about what he was doing, and that they were the ones who were supposed to protect me. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think this rings very true. And I can absolutely understand why Lucy feels more angry at Lita and Mazu.
So this little moment where Strike's first reaction to this is to apologize for not having protected her. And Lucy is so quick to cut him off with, "it's not your fault." I really love that, because it isn't his fault. And I'm sure that won't stop him feeling guilty, but I'm glad she told him so clearly and firmly that it wasn't his job to make sure this didn't happen to her. He did not fail her.
Yeah, I bet Lucy knew exactly how he was going to respond to that, and she had that answer ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
But just a bit before this, though, is where Lucy mentions going to therapy. I kind of feel bad, because I had made a joke when we were doing Ink Black Heart that Lucy really needs therapy. And now I feel like it was unfair, because we didn't have this whole picture of her and I was making assumptions that she wasn't going. I just feel like I need to apologize to a fictional character.
Well, I'm sure that the fictional character appreciates your apology.
I'm sure she does, yeah. But we've been talking about this for a long time, because we knew that therapy was going to be suggested to Strike. I think everyone was a little surprised that this counted as a suggestion, but maybe Strike will think back on this moment at some point and take the hint.
I feel like having a sister who's a therapist and another one who openly talks about being in therapy could possibly keep the topic on his mind. Maybe he'll start wondering, should I be in therapy? And the answer is yes, but we will be starting off book 8 with emotional growth Strike. This could be his next step.
I don't know if I really need this anymore.
Yeah.
But we'll see. And then when Strike says that he isn't in therapy, Lucy's response is interesting. She says, "no," repeated Lucy bitterly. "You don't need it, of course. So self-sufficient, so unmessed up." I'm wondering if she really thinks that he's so unmessed up, because I've always kind of assumed that she does think he is. And that's why she's always trying to get him to do what she wants him to do, to settle down and stuff. So I don't know. Is she just saying that that's his front to the world, or that she really thinks that he's fine?
I think she's saying that he thinks he's so unmessed up, right? She believes that he refuses to see the bad parts of Lita and their childhood, that he refuses to acknowledge the damage it did, which we know is wrong, and which she finds out in a bit is wrong. So both siblings' beliefs about the other are being challenged today.
I really wonder what he was going to say in response to that, though, because he says, "I'm not saying that," said Strike. "I'm not, bloody hell." And then she cuts him off, right? So I'm just curious what he was going to say. I really want to know if he was going to say, like, "no, I am."
I mean, time to flip ahead to the church scene yet again and see his introspection about all the ways in which he's messed up. But seriously, he does do some self-reflection in this book, and we know that he does acknowledge the ways in which their childhood shaped him, damaged him. It's the connection from the "I'm messed up" to maybe therapy is the thing to do for being messed up that he hasn't made. And maybe he never will make that connection. Maybe his self-awareness and his determination, both of which we know he has, will be enough for him to move towards a healthier future.
I think that's probably why I don't need this anymore, because we're seeing him do that
He's doing his own therapy.
Lucy also says that what she talks in therapy about mostly is why she never told anyone. And a little later, she says that she'll never forgive herself for it. And I can't help but think of Robin in contrast and how she later tells Prudence that speaking up and getting justice is what helped her heal. Oh, but that cannot be compared to a 6 or 8 year old, you know, Lucy shouldn't be putting that on her shoulders.
Yeah, 1,000%. My heart breaks for Lucy for bearing this guilt all these years. Yeah. That isn't her guilt to bear. She wasn't responsible for this man's actions. She needs to forgive herself. And I really hope that she can, that maybe this book lets her work towards that.
Yeah. I hope that Mazu ending up in prison and Lucy finally telling Shrike will help her heal from this. But I think it's really important that we see Lucy's bravery acknowledged by Shrike and that there isn't just one right way to deal with this, like he used to think.
Yeah. Well, I think that seeing justice served will be healing for Lucy, because at the end of the day, she is Cormoran's sister. You can see the justice gene in her with, you know, the guilt that she feels. So I feel like Mazu going away and the church being shut down is going to bring her some very healing closure. I can feel it.
Yeah.
Jack, go dry yourself off and then you can have some banana bread, said Lucy, for all the world as though she were perfectly happy. And for the first time in their adult lives, it occurred to Strike that his sister's determination to cling to stability and her notion of normality, her ironclad refusal to dwell endlessly on the awful possibilities of human behavior, was a form of extraordinary courage.
Isn't there a line somewhere where Strike is thinking about Robin in contrast to Lucy, where he's thinking that Lucy tries to pretend this stuff doesn't exist, where Robin faces it? Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I kind of want to read that in this light and see how his thinking has changed.
Yes, there is. And I found it for you. It was in Letha White. And it says, profoundly different though they were, often though she exasperated him, he loved Lucy. Nevertheless, he could not help comparing her with Robin as he bowled towards Manchester. Robin had grown up in what seemed to Strike the very epitome of middle-class stability, but she was courageous in a way that Lucy was not. Both women had been touched by violence and sadism. Lucy had reacted by burying herself where she hoped it would never reach her again. Robin, by facing it almost daily, investigating and resolving other crimes and traumas, driven to do so by the same impulse to actively disentangle complications and disinter truths that Strike recognized in himself. And wow, you were right. I love rereading this bit in this context and seeing the assumptions that Strike has made about Lucy laid out so clearly and so confidently in his head as this is the truth, this is the way she is. And now in this book, his realization that he was wrong, that she's not so different from him, his perspective changing to acknowledge the different forms that bravery can take, that's growth.
Yeah, the fact that he says Robin faces it daily, but Lucy does too, he doesn't know.
Yeah, she has to face it daily in her memories and not let it touch her children.
Her kids, yeah.
God.
Next, we have Strike and Lucy's conversation about Leda. And whenever he admits Leda wasn't fit to be a mother, this is such a big moment for him. And it's really nice to see him being more open and thinking about the less positive sides of her more often.
I think when they started this conversation, Lucy was ready to butt heads with him on this. And his reaction of just agreeing with her is another way she gets a shock, like the epigraph says.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Lucy saying that she'd been waiting for years to hear him say that. It feels like a huge weight was lifted off of both of them in this moment.
It really does.
I think the most important thing Strike says here, though, is when he tells her that he sees a difference in the type of mother she is. That's not just acknowledging her feelings towards Leda, but it's acknowledging how she's overcome it and that he sees it.
Yes, he sees. And more importantly, he values all of the work that she's done to make her corner of the world a better place. He's telling her to her face that she's done a good job with what she set out to do to be a better mom for her kids.
I'm not sure if you both or if listeners will agree with me here, because I know that people have really strong opinions on Leda. But when Strike says that he knows she loved them, I agree with him. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Leda knew how to show love or was responsible enough or selfless enough to have children. But I do agree with him. I don't think that Strike is inventing a love that didn't exist. I think it was real. It meant something to him. It still does. Mm-hmm. I always think of that bit. I think it's in Career of Evil where he thinks that she had loved him enough. Do you know which part I mean?
Yeah, that was in Letha White, actually, when he was comparing himself to Billy. And he says, perhaps the only difference between the two of them was that Strike's mother had lived long enough and loved him well enough to stop him breaking when life threw terrible things at him.
Yeah, I wonder what I'm thinking of in Career of Evil. It must be when he tells Lang, at least my mother loved me.
Oh, yeah.
That, I think that's that what was I was thinking too. That was a good one.
It's like, geez, strike out. I mean, the guy deserves it. Oh,
yeah, he deserved it.
So I agree with you in regards to Lita loving her children, but failing in her duties as a mother to them. And I'm just wondering, and this might be totally random, but can the opposite be true? Can someone be a good parent, a good mother, without loving their kids? Is love a necessary but not sufficient quality to be a good parent? Is my question.
I mean, I would argue no.
No.
I don't. Maybe just because I just finished this book, but it reminds me of Rochester with Adele.
I'm so glad you read it. I'm so glad you finished Jane Eyre, by the way. It's did. So exciting for me.
He gives her everything she needs, but I wouldn't call him a good father figure to her because he never showed her any love.
Yeah.
No.
Thank God she had Jane Adele, I know, in the end.
I wonder if there's an example of that kind of parent in these books, but I couldn't think of one.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to think of that too.
Yeah, my mind immediately went to the Bristows with Lula because they kind of treated her as more like a
trophy, there was on Lady Bristow's side, there was a love there, but it was a very selfish, twisted, obsessive love. But
yeah, I don't know.
I mean, there's so many bad parents in this book.
I know. I really want to talk about this line though that says, "I didn't want her to die," sobbed Lucy. "Jesus, Luce, I know you didn't. I always thought one day I'd have it all out with her, and then it was too late and she was gone." So this is really sad to me. It's not the first time we've seen Lucy grieve for Leda, because we do get that flashback of her sobbing at the kitchen table. Remember that in Troubled Blood?
I do.
But this was a powerful moment where, even though she has so much justifiable anger, I think we're seeing that it still hurts. It must also be hard because I imagine that she must feel like she never got closure because she never got to tell Leda the damage and pain she caused her. And I think personally that she probably unknowingly transferred those feelings of anger onto Strike and fought it out with him at times because, you know, he took her side in her mind. So maybe that's why this conversation can be healing for Lucy, because Strike is giving her the closure that she was never able to get with Leda.
That is such a good psychological insight. And you know what? If Leda had lived and Lucy had that argument, that blowout with her, I don't think Leda would have given her what she needed, the acknowledgement that she did wrong. But Strike can and does give that to her. He sees her pain and he's like, yes, that's right. She's getting better closure from Strike than she ever would have from her mother.
That's true. I really do think it's likely. I think a lot of her Leda anger was pointed at him in certain moments, like probably all of Troubled Blood.
Yes.
Where she's having to relive it so much. It's just big time.
This childhood story that Strike talks about with the Moonbeam family was adorable.
You know what? You know that Joe has this whole story in her head. I want to know the story of the Moonbeam family.
Publish the Moonbeam family, Joe. Publish it. I want to know it.
I thought this was really sweet. I wasn't expecting there to be a story about Leda that I would find sweet and good, but this one did it. Leda was a good storyteller, and it's something that Strike can hold on to as a good memory.
It is absolutely adorable. And I know that we're all pretty much on the they're not having kids train, but indulge me for a moment. Imagine Daddy Strike continuing the story of the Moonbeam family for his own little baby girl, with Mr. and Mrs. Moonbeam fighting the shadow monsters to make the whole world bright, you know, and they always win with the help of their little baby Moonbeam. My ovaries can't handle this.
Sweet. I mean, just because I don't think that they're going to have kids doesn't mean that I hate the idea of it. It's very sweet. I think that that's the kind of dad he would probably be.
Absolutely. And it would be really cute.
It would be.
It would be fucking adorable. He'd probably throw in like random crime details that are definitely not 100% appropriate for a child. And Robin's over here like, I'm sorry, the Moonbeam monster did what? Strike.
That reminds me of the time where he's talking to Jack in the hospital when he's unconscious and then he apologizes because he keeps swearing.
He keeps swearing. Oh my God.
All right. But I love the fierceness that we see from Lucy when she tells him to try and take Mazu down. I like that we're seeing her maybe understand where Strike is coming from with his desire to pursue justice and find order.
Yeah. I think that as soon as she asked this of Strike, we all knew that Mazu was going down, right?
Oh, yeah.
But it's Robin who does the job of taking her down, not Strike, which I think is poetic and kind of ties the two women together in a way, because it's Robin who understands what this kind of violation feels like. And it's Robin who understands the way viscerally that getting justice helps heal that pain. I kind of want these two to have a heart-to-heart about this after this book ends.
And it's also Robin who's the one who says, I think this is what they call closure when she goes to take her down.
Oh, yeah. I want Lucy to call Robin and be like, yeah, I want Strike to first tell her. And then I want Lucy to call Robin for coffee, just thank her for breaking Mazu's nose.
I know that Strike never tells Robin what happened to Lucy.
Yeah.
In fact, he sends her away right before he mentions it to, who does he mention it to? The one witness that they go visit before she... Oh,
the one whose name I haven't looked up how to pronounce yet.
Yes, exactly her.
And I keep meaning to.
Yeah, I know. But Robin's smart. She probably understands that this is a real likelihood, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure she's put that together.
I think so, yes.
So Strike tells Lucy that he's been talking to Prudence.
I love this part where he talks about telling her on impulse out of a desire to be honest because she was honest.
Yeah.
It really goes to what I was saying before about each of them taking these small steps. It keeps opening up the door for the other to take another step and another, you know?
It does. And also, do we remember that suggestion at the end of Ink Black Heart that Strike stopped lying to the women in his life? Well, he's working on that now. And it turns out that being honest with the women in his life has some really positive effects.
Who'd have thunk? Yeah, I was happily surprised by Lucy's reaction.
I honestly wasn't surprised. I remember you guys kind of convincing me that my hope for this might be too much wishful thinking, but my gut was saying that this was going to be good.
And you were right. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think all this really goes to show is that you should never listen to either of us on anything ever.
Not a great message for a podcast. Stop listening to us. So much of that was Strike's opinion, though, right? Because I'm not even sure that they needed to have this open conversation to make Lucy respond like this, since she says that she sees her dad's kids and she's acting like this is no big deal. This is just great. I think he might have been able to tell her that night at the hospital and it would have been fine.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. This is just, it's another completely separate instance of Strike thinking he understands Lucy, only to be proven wrong. She was always going to support this because she really does want Corman to be happy. He was being less generous with her than she deserved in thinking that she'd be jealous and possessive.
So the mention of Charlotte at the end of this chapter is a little ominous in hindsight, where Strike reassures Lucy that that's dead and buried.
And so is she by the end of the book. That's what we call foreshadowing.
It is. Yeah. I'm going to add in a listener question here from Rebecca, who asks, do you feel differently about Lucy now that we know more about her childhood?
That's a good question. And I had always suspected that something like this had happened to her, to be honest. It was sort of my assumption about her character,
right?
That this was trauma that we and Strike didn't know about it, but that it had happened to her. So in that sense, having it revealed as a certainty, it adds depth to her character for me, because now we get the circumstances around it. We get her reactions, Strike reactions. But I don't know that it essentially changes my perspective, just maybe adds more nuance. What about you guys?
I mean, I think that my thoughts are fairly aligned with what you were just saying there towards the end, Bulls, about it kind of adding a little bit more nuance. I don't think it really changes how I feel about her overall, but I feel like it gives her more depth and you kind of understand a little bit more.
The thing is, I do feel differently about her after this book, but it's not because of what happened to her. Mm-hmm. It's like you, I had always assumed that this happened to her, if not at the commune, then somewhere else in their life with Leda. But I don't feel differently about her just because we now have that confirmed. I feel differently about her because we see changes in her as well.
Yes.
And how she interacts with Strike. She's not wanting him to be what she wants. She's not trying to pick fights. All of those things were frustrating before, and it would be frustrating still after having heard the story. Do you know what I mean? Like, it reminds me of Robin when she says, this doesn't define me.
Yeah, it's her growth that changes.
So the answer is yes and no. I do feel differently about Lucy after this book, but it's not because of that. It's because of her growth.
Yeah, that's a good answer. I agree with that. Yeah.
I know this is a hard chapter. There are a lot of really sad things discussed, but the overall feeling I feel from this is happiness. If a chapter could feel like a long overdue hug, that's what this chapter feels like to me.
Yeah.
A hug in Strike's chest, you know.
Very solid.
Very solid, warm, large, strong.
Strong Harry's. I don't know if the chapter's Harry, but while we're listing off adjectives.
The whole chapter is really beautiful, especially knowing that Joe has been planning this for so long.
I too absolutely love this chapter because it's like lancing a boil, you know? It's taking that tension and that weight that's been straining Strike and Lucy's relationship and it's ripping it open. It hurts, but it's necessary to heal and it's a relief. And you can see the good it's doing as the pain is happening.
Yeah, gross, but yeah.
Yeah, it is a gross metaphor. But I think it works. And I would reread this chapter a lot.
Yeah, I have.
It's so satisfying just to see after all of this time, constantly seeing them butting heads and, you know, mm-hmm. being upset with each other. It's just nice to see them kind of finally starting to sort mm-hmm. of understand.
It's the book mm-hmm. of changes.
Love it.
All right. Should we go to chapter 12?
All right. So in chapter 12, Strike thinks about his mother and Charlotte in the aftermath of Lucy's revelation and hooks up with Bijou.
The epigraph, the inferior thing seems so harmless and inviting that a man delights in it. It looks so small and weak that he imagines he may dally with it and come to no harm. And that's hexagram 44, coming to meet.
The inferior thing that he's referring to is hooking up with Bijou or something, right? That's how I interpret it, at least.
I don't know if it's just about the temptation to sleep with Bijou. I was going to say the inferior thing is Bijou.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair.
Maybe you're just being nicer than I am. But yeah, whether it's Bijou or the temptation to sleep with her, Strike thinks that it's harmless. This was the same hexagram that was used a couple chapters back when Strike realizes the UHC was connected to the Aylmerton commune. So if that gives any indication of how bad this decision is.
Yep, this is a very ominous hexagram. The judgment states that it is an unfavorable and dangerous situation, and we must understand and promptly prevent the possible consequences. I don't think that Strike's succeeding in doing that here.
The judgment of this hexagram says, the maiden is powerful. One should not marry such a maiden. But my header deck, it made me laugh a bit when I read it because instead it said, the woman is powerful. Do not take this woman.
Yeah, do not, Strike. Do not take her against a wall. Feels like a line from a Dr. Seuss book. Yeah. It's like, do not take her against a wall. Do not take her in the hall. Do not take her on a ball.
I do not like Bijou's.
Do not like Bijou's bubbles. Yeah. Oh man, that's not an appropriate children's book, but
it's okay. I like it. The cake deck says that such a person needs to be confronted directly in order to stop the problem. Mm-hmm. It must be met and conquered. We're not there yet, but I do think that that's what Strike eventually does with her. Even though he created the problem, he does put a stop to it.
Does. This epigraph is so straightforward. It's time to face Palm, where Strike goes to meet the inferior thing.
Yeah.
Okay, so starting off this chapter, seeing Strike continuing to make an effort with his family is really great.
I love how it describes it as tolerating Greg and Luke with a grace he'd rarely shown.
Luke seems like just as much of a little shit as he was a couple of books ago.
Yeah, he doesn't seem like he's grown out of it to me.
No, although I am not going to lie, Luke hitting Strike with one of these arrows totally made me laugh.
I feel like Strike should do a paintball day with his nephews as an excuse to just empty the barrel on Luke. It might be hard on his leg to do, but it would be
he
so
can just
worth
take
it.
Up one place where he's just, you take know, up hiding the behind
defensive
something.
Position.
Yeah.
He did great.
He might have to explain to Lucy why Luke has all these bruises and the others don't.
Only Luke came home covered in paint. That would be very funny.
It's not actually a bad idea because, like we said, they are getting older.
Yeah.
Trips to the toy store isn't going to cut it anymore. That would actually be fun.
Paintball is perfect. It would be adorable. Strike and Jack could team up against Luke and Adam. Yeah. And it would be great.
Just to make it fair, Jack and Strike against Greg, Adam and Luke.
Well, if we're adding Greg, bring Robin too. Put Robin on Corman and Jack's team.
Yeah.
This is a whole thing now. I want to see it.
And then, as he walks away, I love the image of him walking away, losing that fake smile that he's been forcing, because I can see that image so clearly.
Oh, yeah. I can feel the pain in his cheeks from having to force a smile, because, I've been there.
Strike was a mentally resilient man who'd survived plenty of reverses in his life, not least the loss of part of his right leg. One of the tools of self-discipline he'd forged in youth and honed in the army was a habit of compartmentalization that rarely failed him, but right now it wasn't working. Emotions he didn't want to feel and memories he generally suppressed were closing in on him, and he, who detested anything that smacked of self-indulgence, traveled back towards Denmark Street, brooding so deeply that he barely registered the passing tube stations and realized, almost too late to disembark, that he was already at Tottenham Court Road.
It's fascinating to me that Strike sees his ability to, or habit of compartmentalizing as a tool for self-discipline. This is a tool. Mm-hmm. It's a good thing to him. This has served him well, he thinks, so far in his life. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it has been a good tool in many instances, but it didn't serve him well in personal relationships, right? But the difference is that up until now, it hasn't mattered to him. He's always kept those relationships at an arm's length.
Yeah, you're right. Compartmentalization, it works in terms of functioning. It lets him carry on with his life and work and not have a complete breakdown. But yeah, whether it serves him well in terms of ever actually processing his feelings and healing from his traumas, that's maybe a bit up in the air, but yeah.
And I could hardly blame him for not being able to shut this off. Mm. It would be weird if he could.
Yeah.
I think I had said before that we don't get anything about Leda's murder in this book, but that's not totally true because we get a tiny bit here when Strike thinks about her death, and it gives us a little recap that her death had been ruled as an accidental overdose, but Strike had always believed that it had been her husband who killed her. Mm-hmm. So this mention does make me hopeful that we'll get more about this soon, because I've been wanting this to come back and for us to run into Whitaker again, maybe.
Yes.
So fingers crossed.
I too feel very hopeful that this is a good sign that we got this little recap and we got a mention of Switch in this book too. I think it's priming us for it coming back big time in book 8.
Going back to our reactions episode, I think it was Anna Kiara who pointed out to me that there is one interview where J.K. Rowling says the word murder about Leda's death. We were thinking, well, maybe, since we haven't heard anything, maybe it was accident, but Jo did say the word murder.
She said murder.
I can't remember who said this to me, and I'm so sorry. If you hear this and it's you, please tell me, but someone pointed out that we've all said before that it can't be Whitaker who killed Leda because Strike thinks it is, and therefore it's not. Mm-hmm. But he also thought Gus was enemy, and he was right.
Oh.
So I'm not giving up on my Gillespie-Whitaker theory. And if you don't know what that is, go check out our website. There's a blog post about it.
That's a good point. It's sort of like a yes, but here's the twist.
Exactly.
Right? He's not wrong. He's just missing a giant puzzle piece. And finding that piece is what's going to bring the justice raining down.
Yes. And that giant piece of a puzzle is Peter Gillespie.
Yes. And the embezzlement or something.
Yeah. We'll see if we're right. If we were right about this, I would never shut up about it for the rest of my life.
All of the other predictions that we've gotten way off.
I would meet strangers and be like, one
guess
time
what? Yeah, absolutely. That would be really fulfilling for us.
It I would think. Be
next we finally get to see some anger from Strike about Leda.
The paragraph starts by saying that he had rarely felt as angry at her as he is now, which implies to me that he has felt anger. It's just not something he likes to think about.
Well, on.
It seems like he's much angrier on Lucy's behalf than he's ever been on his own.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Totally relatable, actually.
Part of eldest child syndrome.
Yeah.
Just like that other thing. Was it on here or was it in the Discord? Someone said Strike is such a typical eldest child in that he absolutely hates being told what to do. And if someone tells him what to do, he'll be like, fuck you.
Okay.
He has to raise himself. And I'm like, okay. Why did you come to skewer me with that today?
That must have been in Discord because I don't remember that, but I feel attacked.
You know what? It was in Discord and I felt very attacked. And I'm like, well, you don't have to.
Just at me next time. Damn.
Honest to God. I was like, okay, wow.
But why? He demanded of the Leda in his head. You knew I wanted order and boundaries and a life without endless fucking mess. If you hadn't been what you were, maybe I wouldn't be what I am. Maybe I'm reaping what you sowed. So don't you fucking laugh at the army or me, you with your pedophile mates and the squatters and junkies.
I just realized that this parallels his conversation with an imaginary Charlotte.
Oh my God.
In the church chapter.
You're right.
Here it's an imaginary conversation with Leda. Later it's with Charlotte.
It's so I'm sorry, that's not funny. It's
so
just
good.
Funny.
No, but it's like
how he's irritated by people making that connection. And
in both of them, he talks about not wanting a life with fucking mess. He wants a clean life.
Yeah, it also made me think of another line from Cuckoo's Calling. It says, with the sole support of Uncle Ted, he had vanished into the army and refound there the life he had been taught by Leda. Constant uprooting, self-reliance, and the endless appeal of the new.
To me, it's interesting that his thoughts about the army here in the Running Grave are the opposite of what he was thinking. Yes, because here he's saying that he found what he needed, order, structure, boundaries rather than what Lita gave him. I think actually I mentioned in our episode on this, In Cuckoo's Calling, that the army was actually a combination of what he was familiar with, what he was used to, and also what he craved.
Yeah.
It is both at the same time, which was why it worked for him.
I just feel like this is an interesting thing that he's saying, that as a child, he wanted things like order and boundaries. And the second she dies, he goes and seeks that out, knowing she wouldn't like it. It's almost like that he finally felt free to say, I need this, once she was gone.
For me, I feel like it would have been about freedom and solace, because his sense of responsibility, which kept him in England. He felt nervous enough about going all the way to Oxford, let alone further. Yeah. That sense of responsibility died with Lita. And with that comes the freedom to seek out what he needs to cope with everything that's happened to him.
And again, I'm thinking of chapter 64, when finally finding what he needed within himself once Charlotte has gone.
Yes.
It even says those exact words. The man says, I hope you found what you needed. I have, thanks.
Oh, yes. Oh my God.
There's such parallels here with Lita and Charlotte.
It's huge parallels.
But also, I do like that line, if you hadn't been what you were, maybe I wouldn't be what I am. I don't think he's blaming Lita for any of his problems, really, but it goes so well with what we were talking about before, with the theme of parenting and how you become what you become.
Absolutely. And who he is in many ways a really good man and a very skilled man. And he's mentioned before that his childhood taught him lessons that served him well as a detective. Could he have been as good as he is without those childhood lessons that Lita taught him, even though they were trauma? If his life had been different, if Lita had been different, what would have happened to all the people he's helped with what his upbringing made him, you know?
That's very true. Yeah.
It's like,
I think you see that in a lot of people. The bad that happens, they take it and use it.
Take it and use it for good.
What do you think it means when he says, maybe I'm reaping what you sowed? Do you think it's specifically talking about Robin and the fact that his choices have now led him to be miserable without her?
I think that in a way, all of our lives are really, it's all about reaping what our parents sowed in some way, good or bad, right? We're all, I know, we're all what our parents shaped us to be, and or our childhoods, and what we do with that foundation, how we reap it, it's what makes us who we are, right? What we choose to do with it. But given how quickly his thoughts here turn to Charlotte and then to Robin, I'm guessing that his current romantic circumstances, which we know are taking up a lot of real estate in his brain right now, are a big part of that's what he's reaping.
We've always thought that there are comparisons between Leda and Charlotte, right? That Leda's example of love led him seeking out Charlotte. And, you know, that's always been our consensus.
Yeah. I think we've always felt that.
I suppose that Strike would be irritated by us saying that, because it says that this irritates him. But is he blind to this connection right now? Because there's a clear connection
it's
there.
Very clear. I don't think he's fully accepted that it was in large part his childhood with Lita that drew him to Charlotte and made him stay with her so long. Because we know, but that'll change in the chapter 64. But with his thoughts here about stepping out of their shadows to find happiness, I think that hints that he's starting on the road to acknowledging and accepting that connection. He hasn't fully, but I think that a bit of it is there.
Yeah, I think right now he seems to be focused on how they're different. It's not the same, because they're so different, but he's not seeing the bigger picture. As he says in just a bit, that it was a love tainted by pain. Both of those loves were tainted by pain for him. I do find the differences in them interesting, though, because Leda kind of comes out on top. Even though she was what she was, at least she was compassionate and optimistic. The way that he describes Charlotte is just pure misery. You have to wonder if he ever thinks, like, how he put up with it. Because I'm thinking it.
I mean, they are at their core very different women. But I think that what Strike's life looked like when he was with them, that's where the real similarity is. Because even though they're different, he's cast in the same role, like savior, protector, solid rock in the midst of chaos and uncertainty and mess. So while they might be different, the disease is different, the symptoms are the same.
Yet neither of them knew how to show love.
Yeah, that's where the similarities are, and who he had to be with both of them.
I think it's also just the example of love that Leda gave him, that love can be painful. You can up and leave and come back whenever you want to it. You don't have to be responsible with this love. You can be hurtful and
not accountable.
That's the example that Leda gave him. And because he believes that his mother loved him, which I do agree with him, but he thinks that that has to be accepted with love. And that's what he's doing with Charlotte.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or that's what he did with Charlotte.
No.
It's okay. He doesn't have to do it anymore.
No, he doesn't.
He's found a new
love. I mean, he's causing himself pain by, you know.
Well. We're going to get there.
They wanted him to stride out into the sunlight, free at last to find a less complicated woman and a love untainted by pain. But what was a man supposed to do if he thought he might finally be ready to do that and it was too late?
Why do I love it whenever Strike refers to himself as a man?
Like, what is it? You said it before, and every time I see it now, I think of you because you're like
yeah, he's a man. He's a man, a main man. I don't know why I love it so much. I just do. What is a man supposed to do?
I can't tell you how much I squeed with excitement when I read the words that he might finally be ready to do that. I mean, come on.
Oh, he's my ready God.
To settle down.
Finally ready to do that. I also love the comparison of Robin with sunlight and warmth here.
It's not the first time.
Shadows versus, it's not the first time. And it's, I love it every time.
Alone of the women jostling in his thoughts, Robin brought feelings of warmth, though they were tinged with a bitterness no less easier to bear because it was self-directed. He should have spoken up, should have forced a conversation about their respective feelings before Ryan Murphy swooped in and carried off the prize Strike had complacently thought was his for the taking.
This makes me wonder if he sort of come to terms with the rejection at the beginning of Ink Black Heart, because we had thought that Strike thought, oh, she doesn't want me, she's disgusted by me, right? But here, he talks about their respective feelings. Is it safe to say that Ink Black Heart was a temporary lack of confidence that she didn't want him, but he's back to believing there's something more?
Yes. I think in a nutshell, yeah. I think that his confidence about his feelings being reciprocated was shaken by that rejection, Ink Black Heart, but it wasn't shattered because there's just too much evidence otherwise. Yeah. Like, it's overwhelming, and his own gut feelings are so strong because they're right. Like, he's a detective. Yeah. So after that little blow where he's doubting himself, I think he goes back to, nah, I'm pretty sure I was right.
Yeah.
And now he's fully back to, yeah, there's something there. There was just another reason. But there is that they sense each other.
Of course.
On a deeper level, they know. They know deep down, even if they make themselves doubt it.
So next, Strike receives an email from Wardle with the census information and calls Robin with a couple of leads while she's waiting for Ryan to arrive in flat. There's one for the ex-UHC member Sheila Kennett, and then there's another one for the journalist Fergus Robertson, who's written about the UHC.
Good for Wardle coming through with that.
Yeah, right? Wardle is really a surprising MVP in this novel.
I know.
Seriously.
He's stepping up.
Well, he's got nothing else to do. His wife is gone.
Yeah. Ouch, but true.
When Strike calls Robin to talk about what he found, this is great because Robin is in a place where she's kind of got that work-life balance happening, and Strike is listening in on real life happening. It's those little moments where she gets burned or hearing her kiss TPM hello.
What does TPM
that
mean
prick
for
Murphy.
Listeners who might not? Okay.
Yeah. What do they say in Lethal White? The chisels that they call the TTS?
Oh, yeah. I don't remember what it stands for.
Oh, Tinky the Second.
Yeah. I was just thinking of Strike calling Matthew that twat in his head.
So we have TTM and TPM.
And that made me think Matthew, MCRM, the M's.
What?
And then the C, like their names. So Matthew Cunliffe, Ryan Murphy, MCRM, the M's bracket, the C and the R.
Ah,
right.
I see what you're saying.
You see what I'm saying?
We got to cut all the M's out.
CR, you cut out the vowels and then you add the numerals.
Okay.
And you get a message. I'm just saying.
Wow. Anyway, do you know what I mean? I feel like Strike is getting a little peek into what life could be.
A little peek and see.
From the outside. Yeah. I think it's one of the reasons why it's so hard for Strike to hear this, because he could be over there cooking dinner with her and talking about the case. You know, it has to be hard to be confronted with this when he's already at such a low place.
It really makes me understand what's coming up next, because there's only so much misery that willpower can resist.
Yeah.
You know,
totally.
He's at that limit before Robin is kissing Ryan in his earshot.
Poor Strike. He's hanging on the line thinking he's being all clever and whatnot. And then he ends up getting his feelings hurt.
Yeah. His desire to annoy Murphy, it really backfired on him here.
It did. Just bit him right in the behind.
I want to know what Murphy said to Robin to make her laugh. Mm-hmm. And then she said, no, it's Strike. Because in my head, he says something like, oh, is that your other boyfriend?
Okay. I was just thinking he was like, is that your mom? And I don't know why, just because he seems so cozy with Linda.
Yeah, but that wouldn't have made her laugh, though. He made a joke.
Well, it's not that fucking funny.
And you're firmly with Strike on that one. He can't be that fucking funny.
He's not here yet. Is that your other boyfriend? Is pretty funny, but it's a bit on the nose for Strike. Because, like, yeah, it is.
That's why it's funny, though. I have to say, I'm quite proud of myself for getting something right here. Because after that review came out and we learned that Strike finds comfort in Bijou, I remember the three of us were talking about it. And I said, I bet he'll have just heard from Lucy what happened to her at the commune, and something will happen with Robin and Murphy that will upset him further. I think I had said that he would see them kiss, but hearing this conversation is pretty close.
That's pretty much spot on. And I know. I mean, again, he hears them kiss, which is basically the same thing as seeing them. Worse, because he's imagining the visuals in his head. Like with Robin and Pez, you had to listen to them make out too.
And honestly, this is best case scenario for me. I'm so not as upset that he does this as I thought I was going to be. The biggest reason is probably that it ends so quickly. But another reason is just that I get this. He's in such a bad place. Bijou snuck in just at the right time or the wrong time. You know, it makes sense.
It does. And I mean, on top of all this, having to face more fucking fish. I'd have given in too. I'm not gonna lie. I couldn't have faced the fish in the fridge after all that. I couldn't do it.
All right, so he gets a call from Bijou.
The call.
And it says, he looked down at the cellophane tuna in his hand. He remembered the cleavage. He'd given up smoking and takeaways. Robin was cooking dinner for Ryan Murphy. Yeah, he said. Why not?
Yeah.
There are about half a bajillion reasons why not. Strike, you absolute idiot. Like, I get why he did it, but God.
Again, I don't think this is as terrible as it could be. And it's not like he knows about the semen stealing.
No, how could one know that?
How could anyone know that? Yeah. Right. But yeah, it's like the epigraph says, he thinks it's going to be harmless.
Yeah, he thinks it's just going to be a little cheat day and then he's back on his diet. And he does not foresee all of the horrific consequences that are coming.
All right, let's go to chapter 13.
So in chapter 13, Robin arranges an interview with Sheila Kennett.
So the epigraph to this chapter reads, nine at the beginning means the footprints run crisscross. And that's from hexagram 30, the clinging fire.
This one's a bit tricky. Without looking at any interpretations or the actual Book of Changes, the idea of footprints crisscrossing puts the image in my mind of two people sort of going in the same direction and overlapping. And since this is a very Frank's heavy chapter, this is where we're first introduced to them. We're told that they're not sure which brother is guilty of stalking. I'm wondering if this is a clue that they're both involved. So their footprints are crisscrossing because they're both following the same woman.
Oh, I like that. I hadn't thought of that. Plus, there's the fact that Strike and Robin's paths both cross with Will Enzer here, right? And then sort of narrowly miss each other's, maybe. Yeah.
There is something about the hexagram itself that stands out to me, and that's just the general idea to pay attention to what's around you. The last line of this line judgment, I'm not sure if that's the right way to say. I might need to ask someone.
I think it is, the judgment for this line.
Yeah, it says, it is precisely at the beginning that serious concentration is important because the beginning holds the seed of all that is to follow. I like that mostly because it seems like really good advice for reading these books.
So in this hexagram, the changing lines progress through the day. So in this, the first line, the workday is beginning with the sun rising. It says activity and haste prevail, which feels appropriate for this point in the novel because they're working to get their ducks in a row for this UHC case and juggling their other cases. Their work is starting. But I like that you point out that it says serious concentration is important because this drama going on with Bijou in this chapter is threatening to derail that serious concentration for both of them a little
for
bit.
For all of us.
All of us. But I totally also agree with you about the double meaning you point out, the sort of meta lesson about reading these books. All of the seeds for the rest of the book are being sown in the beginning in these chapters. So you gotta pay attention.
We're all guilty there.
Very guilty.
All right. So this chapter opens with kind of getting people in the agency's reactions to Little John. And I have to say that Barclay's, I think, is probably my favorite, where it says, he just fucking stares, doesn't blink like a fucking lizard.
I Googled this because Robin says she's pretty sure lizards do blink and I needed to know, right? So it says, according to Google, it says, most lizards have eyelids just like we do that clean and protect their eyes when they blink. But some lizards, like geckos, can't blink. and said they have a clear membrane that shields their eyes from dirt or bright sun and use their tongue to clean their eyes.
Oh,
interesting bit of lizard trivia there. So I guess they're both right. It would be super weird if Little John licked his eyes, though, to clean them.
Yeah, that would be incredibly concerning. I would be concerned if I had an employee licking their own eyeballs. I'm not going to lie. Firstly, about the ability. Second of all, about the behavior. Not appropriate for a workplace.
It really reminds me of Men in Black.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
When the one guy blinks with the two sets of eyelids.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool.
I love Men in Black.
Men in Black was a great movie.
Okay, next we see the beginnings of the stalking case with Tasha Mayo and the Franks. And I think this is probably one of my favorite side cases.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree.
I'm into this.
If we're doing our whole connecting to the case thing, it's interesting that we have two individuals who both end up being guilty, just like we have the UHC and Abigail both being guilty. I don't know if that's a stretch, but it's suggesting to me two different guilty parties.
Or like the person, it isn't just one person committing a crime. It's a person
More than
collaborators.
Mm-hmm. Collaborators. It sounds like they're creating a
it does sound like they're working on a project together. Like, you know what I mean?
Yes. Accomplices.
Accomplices. Yes. Great. Much better.
Would you like to be my collaborator for this murder? I would love to collaborate with you on that.
Let's have a session and hash this out. Maybe take some minutes, talk about our important deadlines on this murder.
We had to end our collaboration because we had creative differences
about our murder signature. You know, you got to get the right signature if you're going to do a murder.
Anyway,
I love this case. Mm-hmm. Barclay has nicknamed these men the Frankenstein brothers, Frank 1 and Frank 2 for short, which is an amazing and super appropriate nickname. And if you'll bear with me, I'm going to go into why I think that is. So in the novel Frankenstein, which is written by Mary Shelley, the teenage girl who in writing this basically invented the sci-fi genre. So in the novel, we have Victor Frankenstein and we have the creature he creates who's never given a proper name. So Victor Frankenstein discovers the secret of life. And he becomes obsessed with creating life. And I assume that all the women in his life watching him collect corpses and animal remains to like cobble this together into a horrific creation are side-eyeing him like, so half the human race can already create life and we don't need to go grave robbing to do it, bro, but go on.
Somebody's jealous.
Yeah, some womb envy here. But so he succeeds. He makes a hideous 8-foot-tall, incredibly strong, frightening man and brings him to life. And then instantly freaks out and runs away, abandoning the creature, the newborn 8-foot-tall baby that he's created in his lab. He goes back, and when the creature's gone, he's just like, oh, okay, I'm just gonna do nothing. But meanwhile, the creature teaches himself to talk and read by spying on a family.
That's creepy.
Yeah, but it's also sweet. He does little chores for them without them knowing.
Oh, okay.
He's hiding in their shed. He shovels the walkway and cuts their wood for him, and they think he's like a nice friendly spirit. He is a nice monster.
Okay.
In the beginning, in his nature.
I don't actually know this story.
Yeah, it's great. So he learns to talk and he learns to read from watching them. And he basically falls in love with this family. And he tries to go make friends with them. But when he does, they reject him for being terrifying and he runs away. It's actually really sad. And then he tries to save a little boy's life and he gets shot for his troubles because, again, he looks so scary. And at this point, he vows hatred and revenge on the human race for being assholes, which, you know, fair enough.
I'm feeling an alpha vibe here. Keep going.
Well, he ends up killing Victor's little brother and framing his adopted sister who gets hanged for the crime. And Victor does fuck all to stop that, by the way. But long story short,
too late.
So this creature eventually tells Victor that he needs Victor to create a mate for him. So that he's not alone. He needs to create a woman creature to give. Mm. And if he won't, then he'll kill everyone Victor loves. So he goes to Scotland to make this woman creature for the OG. She's meant to be a blank slate that the creature will just be able to mold to be his perfect mate. But Victor chickens out of this because he's afraid of the creatures reproducing and creating a whole race of monsters.
Right.
But it's like, if you're building her from the ground up, just don't stick a uterus in her, right?
Yeah, maybe leave that part out.
I'm thinking that Victor doesn't know how any of this works. But in any case, the creature's furious. He kills Victor's wife. Victor follows him into the Arctic and they both die full of regrets.
Wow, that sounds cheerful.
It's very cheerful. What is my point with all this?
I don't know.
The two Franks in Frankenstein. So there's Frankenstein and then there's Frankenstein's monster that people often call Frankenstein. So in a way, there are two Franks in Frankenstein. One of them abdicates his responsibility of care. In doing so, creates an absolute disaster that ends up in multiple people dead. The desire of the creature to possess a woman to have a woman literally created for him and given to him is almost fulfilled by the first one before fear makes him abandon it. Everything ends in misery. The eternal question, who is the real monster here? Kind of both of them, but it's all Victor's fault. Mm-hmm. If he hadn't abdicated his responsibility, the creature would not have become a monster. But anyway, so we've got that. But in The Running Grave, we have, again, two Franks. The older one is supposed to be a carer for the other. And both appear to be sharing a twisted, dangerous obsession with taking this woman, with possessing this woman for themselves. And we don't know who the dominant personality in this partnership is. Like, is Frank one the leader? Is Frank two? They've both committed crimes against women. All we can see is they're working together on this horrifying project of taking a woman for themselves, and that they've been escaping the consequences of their crimes by pleading, you know, incompetence, or pleading, I'm taking care of this person who I'm really not. But I guess my point is that I am getting little shades of Victor and the creature, little parallels that are kind of upended in sort of a modern setting here. And as we get more into the Franks in this book, I want to like use this as a base to pick apart how they're sort of a modern version of this dynamic that's going on in Frankenstein and how the changes sort of reflect on that. So I just think it's a very good nickname for these creepy brothers.
It is.
I'm really excited to get more into it. And that was a really long way of saying it. And I'm sorry, but this might be important info for later.
Yeah, that's good. I like it. Keeping the Franks discussion going though, we got a listener question from the Franks. Nope, it's not from the Franks.
I don't want to answer any questions from the Franks.
We got a listener question about the Franks from, I think it's Hi-I-I-I-D on Instagram.
Great name.
That says, didn't the Franks' abduction plan make you extremely nervous for Robin, as there often seem to be parallels between side cases / side case aspects to the main case? I was worried for the entire second half of the book that the UHC would snatch Robin back. Yes, absolutely. Yes. I was already thinking that someone from the cult was going to be watching them. I think I talked about that in predictions. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I read that there was a stalking case, I was worried.
Yep.
And I guess it kind of does happen, right? Because Abigail does stalk them and she has other people following them. So we're right to be concerned about it.
Yeah, she does. And there is that bit where in the car chase scene, Strike's like, yes, the person's in a balaclava, but I don't think it's the Franks. Because it's Abigail. But yeah, I'm right here with you, Heidi. Every time that Robin was alone after she got home from the cult, or every time Will and Ching left Pat's house, I was terrified they were going to be kidnapped back.
Yeah.
I was so certain it was going to happen. I was on the edge of my seat.
I was really scared when the police officers came to Robin's door.
Yes, that they were secretly cult.
Yes.
I was very afraid.
And I almost feel like we're meant to be afraid of that because we have that showdown with the Franks going on. Yes, it's the Frank situation intensified that fear. Yeah, absolutely.
It's all just to make us afraid.
And it is a bit scary when it describes the escalation of the Frank's behavior. I mean, all of it is scary, right? A series of trivial incidents, at first merely irksome, had lately turned sinister with the postings of a dead bird through the woman's letterbox, and then with the gluing up of the keyhole on her front door.
Eesh.
I mean, receiving dead animals is always a threat to someone's life, right? I mean, the Franks aren't cats. This isn't a nice gift.
No, they are not cats. They are not trying to teach Tasha how to hunt.
It's not like, here's a lizard.
Yeah, I caught this for you. No, dead animals are absolutely a threat. And the escalation is a clear danger sign. And it's insane to me that Tasha can't get the cops to do anything.
I know.
I mean, yet at the same time, it does not surprise me at all.
And also, I'm assuming that the gluing up her keyhole means putting some sort of super glue inside the keyhole so that when she came home, she wasn't able to open the door.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if this could have possibly been a kidnapping attempt, because why would you do this unless you want to trap her there for some reason?
I feel like they might have been trying it out as like a strategy to test to see they could hide nearby, see how long it keeps her out,
yeah,
how long she stands there trying to get the key in.
If it would work.
Yeah.
I'm just really glad that Tasha went to the Strike and Ellicott agency and not Patterson.
And not only because it led to a bodyguard romance meet cute with her future wife, I assume.
You know what? This makes me wonder how Beth is doing.
Yeah.
Did Beth ever find out why Midge wanted her password to Drex game? I'm so curious now.
That's a good question. Like, I wonder how her novel's coming. Has she gotten to four paragraphs yet? Are her collages any less shit? These are important questions I need answered. Like, who is Beth mooching off of now?
Well, if that's true, that was Midge's.
If it's true, Midge was very angry, yes.
I'm just curious about the whole Drex game thing. That must have been fascinating for her when it came out in trial. I wonder if she had to testify.
Oh, if they had to, like, say this was my account,
and then I gave it.
Oh, that would have been interesting.
Anyway.
This back and forth between Barkley and Robin is comedy gold. Like Robin's response here of, maybe try and find a topic of mutual interest first, when Barkley's wondering out loud if Little John would say something if he punched him, is perfect.
I like them hanging out being friends.
Yeah, I really like when Barkley is telling Robin how much he didn't like Tasha Mayo's film about Victorian lesbians. Hour and a half of poetry and gardening. The wife loved it. I didn't, because apparently I'm an insensitive prick.
Honestly, I'm absolutely amazed that Barkley actually sat through 90 minutes of that, because there is literally nothing I could do to convince my husband to watch a period drama about Victorian lesbians. But this period drama about Victorian lesbians is obviously modeled after Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which is has been on my to watch list for ages, because I actually am all about a period drama about Victorian lesbians. It's right up my alley. So
anyway, when we're talking about the Franks, Robin says the problem is, how do you stop someone being obsessed? First of all, no idea. Nothing has helped me not be obsessed with these books. So I don't know, Robin.
If someone figures this out, let me know, because I got nothing.
I don't really want help, though. That's part of my problem with this.
Yeah, well, neither do they, I'm guessing. Just let us drown in our obsessions.
Yeah,
okay.
We're fine. We're fine.
We're not criminal in our obsessions. Just frightening, nutty, a bit quirky.
But this also connects to the case for me, because sure, they're going to send the high ups to prison. But how do you stop people like Becca from being obsessed with the ideas of the UHC?
Exactly. And with getting people like Will out of the cult, you know, the perennial problem of helping people escape. How do you free someone's mind from an idea that's so firmly implanted there?
Okay, so next Robin gets a couple of phone calls. Her first phone call is from Strike, who's calling with a few updates. And he has been a busy bee.
In many ways.
Yeah, definitely. He arranged an interview with Fergus Robertson. He spotted Will collecting for the UHC, and he also acquired Sheila Kennett's number.
It's pretty shocking to hear him say how thin Will is, because over 6 foot, but thinner than Robin. That's really concerning.
It really is. Add in that Strike says he definitely looks unhappy, and it's a very clear contrast to the image of the UHC that Robin's been presented at their services so far. It's a little crack in this sort of shiny, happy facade. Yeah.
It's one of those things where you think people might notice and be concerned about how small he is, but be too afraid to say something or do that thing. Well, if they seem happy, it's harmless, you know?
Yeah, it's like, not my business. Yep. If it's nobody's business, then I don't have an ending to that.
Yeah, I know what you meant.
I was trying to come up with an aphorism.
Mm-hmm.
Then nobody's going to make it their business. No, that doesn't work. That doesn't work. Never mind.
We all know what you mean.
You know what I'm saying, right? Yeah. You get it. Mm-hmm.
So the second phone call that Robin gets is from Ilsa. And oh boy, this is a fun one.
Yeah, are y'all ready? I'm ready for this.
All right. So when she first picks up the phone to Ilsa, Ilsa is coming in hot. She is pissed.
Well, knowing how much Ilsa dislikes Bijou and knowing what Ilsa knows about her, it almost seems pretty calm.
Honestly, yeah, her reaction is very reasonable, because we were all out here raging just as hard at Strike when he first realized what he was going to do. Or, I mean, at least I was.
Spiraling, I think, is what was happening to me.
Spiraling is an accurate representation of your process. Yeah, I was real mad at Strike. I was like, what the fuck, man? We believed in you.
Yeah, I was definitely spiraling. I also have to wonder if calling Robin was a little more calculated than Ilsa is letting on.
Oh, how so? She's clear that she wants Robin to warn Strike.
Right.
Is that she has an ulterior motive to make Robin jealous? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, we know she likes that motive, because she uses it for, you know, she tells Robin to use it, right? But yeah,
that didn't backfire at all. 8 months relationship later.
Could just be raging, but I don't think it's out of the question that this is in the back of her mind.
Let Robin know what's going on here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I love that we got the detail that it was up against Bijou's bedroom wall.
I think she knows what she's doing, right? With Robin's mouth hanging open because she's picturing it. I don't think she's shocked that he slept with someone, but the detail of it.
The detail is what throws Robin.
Yeah.
Honestly, you really relate to her in this moment. Your whole mouth hanging open as the mental picture forms. You're like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Wow. Thanks, Ilsa.
Why we love Ilsa.
Bless her.
Okay, so why on earth would Ilsa think that Robin, of all people, telling Strike not to screw Bijou would be a good idea?
I mean, I think I can see her logic. First, mm-hmm. I do think that she sees the benefit of telling Robin and maybe making her jealous. And also, I think she knows that Robin and Strike are closer than she is with Strike. I think she probably thinks that he might be more likely to listen to Robin.
Agreed. Plus, I'm guessing that Ilsa knows exactly how Cormoran's going to react to her telling him. And she was really hoping that she could dodge that little angry bullet and make Robin take one for the team, you know?
Yeah. One thing that I think needs to be clarified, though, is that Ilsa thinks Bijou's after any rich husband and baby. Mm-hmm. And that Bijou must think that Strike is rich because he's a bit famous. But mm-hmm. I think the truth is that Bijou wants one particular man.
Yeah, she's after that specific QC, the humbled yes. guy. Her gambit with Strike, as he recognizes, I think, was to try to make the one she really wanted jealous. Yeah, like that's what she's going for here.
I agree, but Ilsa, mm-hmm. I don't think, is seeing that picture. Yeah.
All right, so next up is Robin's denial whenever Ilsa's talking about Strike using Bijou as a quote-unquote displacement fuck. Mm-hmm. It's like, girl, come on.
Yeah, right? I don't know if it's denial yet. Robin asks what she means, which is a ridiculous thing to ask Robin.
Yeah.
I mean, she knows exactly what she means, but she didn't get a chance to deny it, mm-hmm. which I'm angry about.
I really identified with Ilsa's exasperation at Robin asking this because, like you said, Kenz, come on, Robin. Honestly, I hope that Ilsa got handed an enormous glass of wine by her husband as soon as she got home, because it has been a day for her and she deserves it after all of this nonsense that she is dealing with because her two best friends are morons.
A very vivid mental picture had presented itself to her while Ilsa talked of Bijou in her shocking pink dress, long tanned legs wrapped around Strike, and it wasn't immediately impossible to erase the image, especially as her imagination had given Strike quite a hairy ass. I'm just going to say, if you ever need a laugh, listen to Robert Glenister read this, because his inflection is hilarious when the sentence ends. And also, for the record, I'm team hairy ass.
Oh, that's an image. It's an image.
This moment really served as a way to break the tension for me, because I was worried about how Robin was going to react when she found out. But this was, it was a funny moment. And it kind of made me see it was going to be fine, you know? Yeah.
It was funny. Her reaction here is so different when she found out about Madeline last book, because he hadn't kept it a secret from her, because she's been spending the past 8 months ignoring and suppressing her feelings. So maybe she's less susceptible to that shock. It's a very different reaction.
Yeah, I kind of think that in Ink Black Heart, Robin was at the beginning thinking there was hope for them. Mm-hmm. I think she thought, okay, he tried to kiss me, so there must be something. I think that Robin was operating on what could happen between us now. And then when she found out about Madeline, it was like, oh, he doesn't want anything. So I think that that's where the shock and the hurt came from with that.
Okay, that makes sense.
Which leads us into this great listener question from Instagram from Sacred Poppy, who said, did you think it was sexy when Robin thought about Cormoran's hairy ass or nah?
I love that this is like the second response we got to this question.
Seriously. Listen, it was like a
beep. Our audience knows us. We're all on the same page here for the most part about the important stuff.
And the important stuff. I'm not quite sure what we're being asked. Like if we think a hairy ass is sexy or if Robin thinks the idea of it is sexy. But I think the point is, and why we all love this part, is that she thinks Strike is sexy. So it doesn't matter whether he does or doesn't. Mm-hmm. Katie said the other day when we were talking about this for the 100th time that the point is that she wants to know. She's imagining it. She can't shake the image. And that's why it's sexy, because it's all wrapped up in her feelings for him and the fact that she's imagining him in a very sexual way.
Just the hairy arse she's imagining isn't sexy. It's sexy because it strikes hairy arse she's imagining. In specifics.
Yes.
Also, can I just say, we've come a long way since Troubled Blood, because she used to get embarrassed just imagining him in shorts, and now she's imagining him screwing women up against walls. We've come so far.
That's growth.
I mean, she's also tries not to picture him naked in the shower later on in the book, so...
Love more details about that scenario in her head.
I go back to still thinking that this is kind of important and not just silliness to see more physical attraction from her.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's what we're starting to get with the electric bits.
Yeah.
It's nice. Okay. So next, Robin calls Sheila Kennett.
I would love a timeline for the UHC. That'd be so mm-hmm. helpful for this book, because mm-hmm. I'm always having to pause for a second when it talks about who was at the farm and when and with who.
Yeah, we need like mm-hmm. colored overlapping bars for yeah. all the characters in the time period, I think.
I couldn't help but think about Betty Fuller when Robin is setting up this interview, because both women, elderly women with sharp memories. I was just glad that this woman reacted very differently to Robin than our dear old Betty did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The fact that Sheila had seen Kevin's death in the paper and mm-hmm. wondered about him, and that seemed to be a deciding factor for her in agreeing to talk to Robin, that was a good sign for me, because it seemed like she'd be on the side of good. Be on the side of, yeah, if I can help get justice, I will, you know?
After arranging her interview, Robin spots Will close to Rupert Court Temple.
Is it weird that both Strike and Robin see Will at separate times on the same day? Or is it just because they're both in the same area?
Yeah, it's not weird. Because, like you said, same area. And as we established previously, London can be a very small place in certain mm-hmm. areas. And the people in cult outfits collecting money are going to stand out. It's kind of hard to miss them. Like, yeah. they draw the eye.
I do love how it says that Robin yearned to get close to him but couldn't, because it just shows how badly she wants this case and wants to help.
We also see Tayo here for the first time, although we don't know that it's him. Yeah, well, yeah. indeed.
Wish it was the last.
Yeah, he's lecturing Will, who reminds Robin of an abused donkey, which is a much less romantic donkey than the one we got in Troubled Blood.
Yeah.
I wonder why Will gets sent back to the farm soon after this, because it must have been soon in order to be there when Robin is. Does his attitude here somehow mean he needs reindoctrination, like his unhappy, compliant, but clearly not listening kind of attitude?
Am I missing something? Because I was thinking that sometimes they just go.
Well, they go to the nearby Chapman Farm place, but mm-hmm. that's not London that they go to in that one chapter. That's like a close.
No, I know. City. I just thought that sometimes they go to different places. So this was just happened to be where they took them for this time.
I think it would be like temporary cult housing in London where they go out collecting, wouldn't it be? Because it's an awful long way to drive from the farm. Well, so and Chapman Farm is where they get sent back from the centers for reindoctrination. But yeah, you could be right. It could just be a day trip.
A long drive is, depending on who you ask, I think.
For the Brits, it might be a long drive.
But no, I had never imagined that Will wasn't always at the farm. So in my mind, that this was just a day or two thing.
A long weekend?
Yeah.
Maybe.
But I think that is...
Oh, that's the end of the chapter.
I think that's the end of the chapter and the end of this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what are we doing next time?
Okay, so next episode, we're doing chapters 14 through 16. So in these chapters, we see Strike's interview with Fergus Robertson. We get an update on some of those ex-UHC members, and Robin and Murphy have their first fight.
That'll do it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoy what you've heard, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod. You can also contact us on our website at thesefilespod.com or email us directly at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.